pretty outstanding menu, your choices are less likely to result in indigestion. Spinoffs. The first investment area we'll visit is surprisingly unappetizing. It's an area of discarded corporate refuse, usually referred to as spinoffs. Spinoffs can take many forms, but the end result is usually the same. A corporation takes a subsidiary, division, or part of its business, and separates it from the parent company by creating a new independent, freestanding company. In most cases, shares of the new spin-off company are distributed or sold to the parent company's existing shareholders. There are plenty of reasons why a company might choose to unload or otherwise separate itself from the fortunes of the business to be spun off. There is really only one reason to pay attention when they do. You can make a pile of money investing in spin-offs. The facts are overwhelming. Stocks of spin-off companies, and even shares of the parent companies that do the spinning off, significantly and consistently outperform the market averages. One study completed at Penn State covering a 25-year period ending in 1988 found that stocks of spin-off companies outperformed their industry peers and the Standard & Poor's 500 by about 10% per year in their first 3 years of independence. The parent companies also managed to do pretty well, outperforming the companies in their industry by more than 6% annually during the same 3-year period. Other studies have reached similarly promising conclusions about the prospects for spin-off companies. What can these results mean for you? If you accept the assumption that over long periods of time the market averages a return of approximately 10% per year, then theoretically outperforming the market by 10% could have you earning 20% annual returns. If the past experience of these studies holds true in the future, spectacular results could be achieved merely by buying a portfolio of recently spun-off companies. Translation: 20% annual returns. No special talents or utensils required. But what happens if you're willing to do a little of your own work? Picking your favorite spin-off situations, not merely buying every spin-off or a random sampling, should result in annual returns even better than 20%. Pretty significant, considering that Warren Buffett, everyone's favorite billionaire, has only managed to eke out 28% annually, albeit over 40 years. Is it possible that just by picking your spots within the spin-off area, you could achieve results rivaling those of an investment great like Buffett? Nah, you say. Something's wrong here. First of all, who's to say that spin-offs will continue to perform as well in the future as they have in the past? Second, when everyone finds out that spin-offs produce these extraordinary returns, won't the prices of spin-off shares be bid up to the point where the extra returns disappear? And finally, about these results even greater than 20%, why should you have an edge in figuring out which spin-offs have the greatest chance for outsized success? O ye of little faith! Of course, spin-offs will continue to outperform the market averages. And yes, even after more people find out about their sensational record. As for why you'll have a great shot at picking the really big winners, that's an easy one. You'll be able to because I'll show you how. To understand the hows and the whys, let's start with the basics. Why do companies pursue spin-off transactions in the first place? Usually, the reasoning behind a spin-off is fairly straightforward. Unrelated businesses may be separated via a spin-off transaction so that the separate businesses can be better appreciated by the market. For example, a conglomerate in the steel and insurance business can spin off one of the businesses and create an investment attractive to people who want to invest in either insurance or steel, but not both. Of course, before a spin-off, some insurance investors might still have an interest in buying stock in the conglomerate, but most likely only at a discount, reflecting the forced purchase of an unwanted steel business. Sometimes the motivation for a spin-off comes from a desire to separate out a bad business so that an unfettered good business can show through to investors. This situation, as well as the previous case of two unrelated businesses, may also prove a boon to management. The bad business may be an undue drain on management time and focus. As separate companies, a focused management group for each entity has a better chance of being effective. Sometimes a spin-off is a way to get value to shareholders for a business that can't be easily sold. Occasionally, a business is such a dog that its parent company can't find a buyer at a reasonable price. If the spin-off is merely in an unpopular business that still earns some money, the parent may load the new spin-off with debt. In this way, debt is shifted from the parent to the new spin-off company, creating more value for the parent. On the other hand, a really awful business may actually receive additional capital from the parent, just so the spin-off can survive on its own and the parent can be rid of it. Tax considerations can also influence a decision to pursue a spin-off instead of an outright sale. If a business with a low tax basis is to be divested, a spin-off may be the most lucrative way to achieve value for shareholders. If certain IRS criteria are met, a spin-off can qualify as a tax-free transaction. Neither the corporation nor the individual stockholders incur a tax liability upon distribution of the spin-off shares. A cash sale of the same division or subsidiary with the proceeds dividend out to shareholders would, in most cases, result in both a taxable gain to the corporation and a taxable dividend to shareholders. A spin-off may solve a strategic, antitrust, or regulatory issue, paving the way for other transactions or objectives. In a takeover, sometimes the acquirer doesn't want to, or can't for regulatory reasons, buy one of the target company's businesses. A spin-off of that business to the target company shareholders prior to the merger is often a solution. In some cases, a bank or insurance subsidiary may subject the parent company or the subsidiary to unwanted regulations. A spin-off of the regulated entity can solve this problem. The list could go on. It is interesting to note, however, that regardless of the initial motivation behind a spin-off transaction, newly spun-off companies tend to handily outperform the market. Why should this be? Why should it continue? Luckily for you, the answer is that these extra spin-off profits are practically built into the system. The spin-off process itself is a fundamentally inefficient method of distributing stock to the wrong people. Generally, the new spin-off stock isn't sold. It's given to shareholders who, for the most part, were investing in the parent company's business. Therefore, once the spin-off's shares are distributed to the parent company's shareholders, they are typically sold immediately, without regard to price or fundamental value. The initial excess supply has a predictable effect on the spin-off's stock price. It is usually depressed. Supposedly shrewd institutional investors also join in the selling. Most of the time, spin-off companies are much smaller than the parent company. A spin-off may be only 10 or 20% the size of the parent. Even if a pension or mutual fund took the time to analyze the spin-off's business, often the size of these companies is too small for an institutional portfolio, which only contains companies with much larger market capitalizations. Many funds can only own shares of companies that are included in the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, an index that includes only the country's largest companies. If an S&P 500 company spins off a division, you can be pretty sure that right out of the box, that division will be the subject of a huge amount of indiscriminate selling. Does this practice seem foolish? Yes. Understandable? Sort of. Is it an opportunity for you to pick up some low-priced shares? Definitely. Another reason spin-offs do so well is that capitalism, with all its drawbacks, actually works. When a business and its management are freed from a large corporate parent, pent-up entrepreneurial forces are unleashed. The combination of accountability, responsibility, and more direct incentives take their natural course. After a spin-off, stock options, whether issued by the spin-off company or the parent, can more directly compensate the management of each business. Both the spin-off and the parent company benefit from this reward system. In the Penn State study, the largest stock gains for spin-off companies took place not in the first year after the spin-off, but in the second. It may be that it takes a full year for the initial selling pressure to wear off before a spin-off stock can perform at its best. More likely, though, it's not until the year after a spin-off that many of the entrepreneurial changes and initiatives can kick in and begin to be recognized by the marketplace. Whatever the reason for this exceptional second-year performance, the results do seem to indicate that when it comes to spin-offs, there is more than enough time to do research and make profitable investments. One last thought on why the spin-off process seems to yield such successful results for shareholders of the spin-off company and the parent. In most cases, if you examine the motivation behind a decision to pursue a spin-off, it boils down to a desire on the part of management and a company's board of directors to increase shareholder value. Of course, since this is their job and primary responsibility, theoretically, all management and board decisions should be based on this principle. Although that's the way it should be, it doesn't always work that way. It may be human nature or the American way or the natural order of things, but most managers and boards have traditionally sought to expand their empire, domain, or sphere of influence, not contract it. Perhaps that's why there are so many mergers and acquisitions, and why so many, especially those outside of a company's core competence, fail. Maybe that's why businesses, airlines and retailers come to mind, continually expand, even when it might be better to return excess cash to shareholders. The motives for the acquisition or expansion may be confused in the first place. However, this is rarely the case with a spin-off. Assets are being shed and influence lost, all with the hope that shareholders will be better off after the separation. It is ironic that the architects of a failed acquisition may well end up using the spin-off technique to bail themselves out. Hopefully, the choice of a spin-off is an indication that a degree of discipline and shareholder orientation has returned. In any case, a strategy of investing in the shares of a spin-off or parent company should ordinarily result in a pre-selected portfolio of strongly shareholder-focused companies. Choosing the best of the best. Once you're convinced that spin-off stocks are an attractive hunting ground for stock market profits, the next thing you'll want to know is, how can you tilt the odds even more in your favor? What are the attributes and circumstances that suggest one spin-off may outperform another? What do you look for and how hard is it to figure out? You don't need special formulas or mathematical models to help you choose the really big winners. Logic, common sense, and a little experience are all that's required. That may sound trite, but it is nevertheless true. Most professional investors don't even think about individual spin-off situations. Either they have too many companies to follow, or they can only invest in companies of a certain type or size, or they just can't go to the trouble of analyzing extraordinary corporate events. As a consequence, just doing a little of your own thinking about each spin-off opportunity can give you a very large edge. Hard to believe? Let's review some examples to see what I mean. Case study. Host Marriott, Marriott International. During the 1980s, Marriott Corporation aggressively expanded its empire by building a large number of hotels. However, the cream of their business was not owning hotels, but charging management fees for managing hotels owned by others. Their strategy, which had been largely successful, was to build hotels, sell them, but keep the lucrative management contracts for these same hotels. When everything in the real estate market hit the fan in the early 1990s, Marriott was stuck with a load of unsaleable hotels in an overbuilt market, and burdened with the billions in debt it had taken on to build the hotels. Enter Stephen Ballenbach, financial whiz, with a great idea. Ballenbach, fresh from helping Donald Trump turn around his gambling empire, and then chief financial officer at Marriott, now CEO of Hilton, figured a way out for Marriott. The financial covenants in Marriott's publicly traded debt allowed, or rather did not prohibit, the spinning off of Marriott's lucrative management contracts business, which had a huge income stream, but very few hard assets. Ballenbach's concept was to leave all of the unsaleable hotel properties and the low-growth concession business, burdened with essentially all of the company's debt. in one company, Host Marriott, and spin off the highly desirable management service business, more or less debt-free, into a company to be called Marriott International. According to the plan, Bollenbach would become the new chief executive of Host Marriott. Further, Marriott International, the good Marriott, would be required to extend to Host Marriott a $600 million line of credit to help with any liquidity needs, and the Marriott family, owners of 25% of the combined Marriott Corporation, would continue to own 25% stakes in both Marriott International and Host. The spin-off transaction was scheduled to be consummated sometime in the middle of 1993. Keep in mind, no extensive research was required to learn all this. The Wall Street Journal and many other major newspapers laid out all this background information for me when Marriott first announced the split-up in October 1992. It didn't take more than reading this basic scenario in the newspapers, though, to get me very excited. After all, here was a case where in one fell swoop, an apparently excellent hotel management business was finally going to shed billions in debt and a pile of tough-to-sell real estate. Of course, as a result of the transaction creating this new powerhouse, Marriott International, there would be some toxic waste. A company would be left, Host Marriott, that retained this unwanted real estate and billions in debt. Obviously, I was excited about the toxic waste. Who the hell is going to want to own this thing was the way my thinking went. No institution, no individual, nobody and their mother would possibly hold on to the newly created Host Marriott after the spinoff took place. The selling pressure would be tremendous. I'd be the only one around scooping up the bargain-priced stock. Now, almost anyone you talk to about investing will say that he is a contrarian, meaning he goes against the crowd and conventional thinking. Clearly, by definition, everyone can't be a contrarian. That being said, I'm a contrarian. That doesn't mean I'll jump in front of a speeding Mack truck just because nobody else in the crowd will. It means that if I've thought through an issue, I try to follow my own opinion even when the crowd thinks differently. The fact that everyone was going to be selling Host Marriott after the spinoff didn't by itself mean that the stock would be a great contrarian buy. The crowd, after all, could be right. Host Marriott could be just what it looked like, a speeding Mack truck loaded down with unsalable real estate and crushing debt. On the other hand, there were a few things about this situation beyond its obvious contrarian appeal. It looked awful that made me willing, even excited, to look a bit further. In fact, Host Marriott had a number of characteristics that I look for when trying to choose a standout spin-off opportunity. 1. Institutions don't want it, and their reasons don't involve the investment merits. There were several reasons why institutional portfolio managers or pension funds wouldn't want to own Host Marriott. We've already covered the issue of huge debt and unpopular real estate assets. These arguments go to the investment merits and might be very valid reasons not to own Host. However, after the announcement of the transaction in October 1992, only a small portion of the facts about Host Marriott had been disclosed. How informed could an investment judgment at this early stage really be? From the initial newspaper accounts, though, Host looked so awful that most institutions would be discouraged from doing any further research on the new stock. Since a huge amount of information and disclosure was sure to become available before the spin-off's fruition, estimated to be in about 9 months, I vowed to read it, first, to see if Host was going to be as bad as it looked, and second, because I figured almost nobody else would. Another reason why institutions weren't going to be too hot to own Host was its size. Once again, not exactly the investment merits. According to analysts quoted in the initial newspaper reports, Host would account for only about 10 or 15% of the total value being distributed to shareholders, with the rest of the value attributable to the good business, Marriott International. A leveraged, highly indebted stock with a total market capitalization only a fraction of the original $2 billion Marriott Corporation, was probably not going to be an appropriate size for most of Marriott's original holders. Also, Host was clearly in a different business than most institutional investors had been seeking to invest in when they bought their Marriott shares. Host was going to own hotels, whereas the business that attracted most Marriott investors was hotel management. Though owning commercial real estate and hotels can be a good business, the Marriott group of shareholders, for the most part, had other interests and were likely to sell their Host shares. Sales of stock solely for this reason would not be based on the specific investment merits and therefore might create a buying opportunity. Note: for reasons unique to the Marriott case, the spin-off was actually considered, at least technically, to be Marriott International, even though its stock would represent the vast majority of the value of the combined entities. For purposes of this illustration, and for the purposes of being accurate in every sense other than technical, it will be more helpful to think of Host, the entity comprising 10 to 15% of Marriott's original stock market valuation, as the spin-off. 2. Insiders want it. Insider participation is one of the key areas to look for when picking and choosing between spin-offs. For me, the most important area. Are the managers of the new spin-off incentivized along the same lines as shareholders? Will they receive a large part of their potential compensation in stock, restricted stock, or options? Is there a plan for them to acquire more? When all the required public documents about the spin-off have been filed, I usually look at this area first. In the case of Host Marriott, something from the initial press reports caught my eye. Stephen Bolenbach, the architect of the plan, was to become Host's chief executive. Of course, as the paper reported, he had just helped Donald Trump turn around his troubled hotel and gambling empire. In that respect, he seemed a fine candidate for the job. One thing bothered me, though. It didn't make sense that the man responsible for successfully saving a sinking ship, by figuring out a way to throw all that troubled real estate and burdensome debt overboard, should voluntarily jump the now secured ship into a sinking lifeboat, Host Marriott. "Great idea, Bolenbach," the story would have to go. "I think you've really saved us. Now, when you're done throwing that real estate and debt overboard, why don't you toss yourself over the side as well? Pip, pip, use that wobbly lifeboat if you want. Cheerio!" It could have happened that way. More likely, I thought, Host might not be a hopeless basket case, and Bolenbach was going to be well incentivized to make the new company work. I vowed to check up on his compensation package when the SEC documents were filed. The more stock incentive, the better. Additionally, the Marriott family was still going to own 25% of Host after the spinoff. Although the chief reason for the deal was to free up Marriott International from its debt and real estate burden, after the spinoff was completed, it would still be to the family's benefit to have the stock of Host Marriott thrive. 3. A previously hidden investment opportunity is created or revealed. This could mean that a great business or a statistically cheap stock is uncovered as a result of the spinoff. In the case of Host, though, I noticed a different kind of opportunity: tremendous leverage. If the analysts quoted in the original press reports turned out to be correct, Host stock could trade at $3 to $5 per share. But the new company would also have somewhere between $20 to $25 per share in debt. For purposes of our example, let's assume the equity in Host would have a market value of $5 per share, and the debt per Host share would be $25. That would make the approximate value of all the assets in Host $30. Thus, a 15% move up in the value of Host's assets could practically double the stock. 0.15 times $30 equals $4.50. Great work if you can get it. What about a 15% move down in value? Don't ask. I doubted, however, that Host Marriott would be structured to sink into oblivion, at least not immediately. I knew that all the new host shareholders had good reason to dump their toxic waste on the market as soon as possible. With the prospect of liability and lawsuits from creditors, employees, and shareholders, though, I suspected that a quick demise of host Marriott, the corporation, was not part of the plan. Add to this the facts that Marriott International, the good company, would be on the hook to lend Host up to $600 million, the Marriott family would still own 25% of Host, and Bollenbach would be heading up the new company. It seemed in everyone's best interest for Host Marriott to survive and hopefully thrive. At the very least, after I did some more work, it seemed likely that with such a leveraged payoff, it had the makings of an exciting bet. Believe it or not, far from being a one-time insight, tremendous leverage is an attribute found in many spin-off situations. Remember, one of the primary reasons a corporation may choose to spin off a particular business is its desire to receive value for a business it deems undesirable and troublesome to sell. What better way to extract value from a spin-off than to palm off some of the parent company's debt onto the spin-off's balance sheet? Every dollar of debt transferred to the new spin-off company adds a dollar of value to the parent. The result of this process is the creation of a large number of inordinately leveraged spin-offs. Though the market may value the equity in one of these spin-offs at $1 per every $5, $6, or even $10 of corporate debt in the newly created spin-off, $1 is also the amount of your maximum loss. Individual investors are not responsible for the debts of a corporation. Say what you will about the risks of investing in such companies, the rewards of sound reasoning and good research are vastly multiplied when applied in these leveraged circumstances. In case you haven't been paying attention, we've just managed to build a very viable investment thesis or rationale for investing in Host Marriott stock. To review, Host could turn out to be a good pick because most sane institutional investors were going to sell their Host Marriott stock before looking at it, which would hopefully create a bargain price. Key insiders, subject to more research, appeared to have a vested interest in Host's success, and tremendous leverage would magnify our returns if Host turned out for some reason to be more attractive than its initial appearances indicated. If events went our way, with any luck, these attributes would help us do even better than the average spin-off. So, how did things work out? As expected, and hoped, many institutions managed to sell their Host stock at a low price. Insiders, according to the SEC filings, certainly ended up with a big vested interest, as nearly 20% of the new company's stock was made available for management and employee incentives. Finally, Host's debt situation, a turnoff for most people, though a potential opportunity for us, turned out to be structured much more attractively than it appeared from just reading the initial newspaper accounts. So how'd it work out? Pretty well, I think. Host Marriott stock, aka the toxic waste, nearly tripled within 4 months of the spinoff. Extraordinary results from looking at a situation that practically everyone else gave up on. Are you ready to give up? Too much thinking? Too much work? Can't be bothered with all those potential profits? Or maybe, just maybe, you'd like to learn a little bit more. Digging for buried treasure. So far, the only work we've really discussed has been reading about a potentially interesting situation in the newspaper. Now, you knew there was a catch. It gets a bit more involved. You're about to be sent off on a mind-numbing journey into the arcane world of investment research, complete with multi-hundred-page corporate documents and mountains of Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, filings. Before you panic, take a deep breath. There's no need to quit your day job. Sure, there will be some work to do, a little sleuthing here, some reading over there, but nothing too taxing. Just think of it as digging for buried treasure. Nobody thinks about the actual digging. Insert shovel, step on shovel, fling dirt over shoulder, when a little treasure is on the line. When you're digging with an exciting goal in sight, the nature of the task changes completely. The same thinking applies here. Essentially, it all boils down to a simple two-step process. First, identify where you think the treasure, or in our case, the profit opportunity, lies. Second, after you've identified the spot, preferably marked by a big red X, then and only then, start digging. No sense and no fun digging up the whole neighborhood. So at last you're ready to go. You're prospecting in a lucrative area, spin-offs. You have a plausible investment thesis, one that may help you do even better than the average spin-off. Now it's time to roll up your sleeves and do a little investigative work. Right? Well, that is right. Only not so fast. In the Marriott example, the spin-off plan was originally announced in October 1992. Although the deal garnered plenty of press coverage over the ensuing months, the relevant SEC filings were not available until June and July 1993. The actual spin-off didn't take place until the end of September, nearly a year after initial disclosure. While 6 to 9 months is a more usual time frame, in some cases the process can stretch to over a year. If you have an impatient nature and are partial to fast action, waiting around for spin-offs to play out fully may not be for you. Horse racing never succeeded in Las Vegas because most gamblers couldn't wait the 2 minutes it took to lose their money. The same outcome, only more immediate, was available in too many other places. The financial markets have also been known to accommodate those who prefer instant gratification. On the other hand, having the time to think and do research at your own pace and convenience without worrying about the latest in communication technologies has obvious advantages for the average non-professional investor. Besides, once you've spent a year prospecting in the Wall Street Journal or in countless other business publications for interesting spin-off opportunities, there should, at any given time, be at least one or two previously announced and now imminent spin-offs ripe for further research and possible investment. As a matter of fact, here comes another one now. Case study: Stratech Security, Briggs & Stratton. In May of 1994, Briggs & Stratton, a manufacturer of small gas-powered engines used mostly in outdoor power equipment, announced its intention to spin off its automotive lock division. The spin-off was slated to take place in late 1994 or early in 1995. The Automotive Lock Division, later to be named Stratech Security, was a small division representing less than 10% of Briggs & Stratton's total sales and earnings. Since Briggs, the parent company, was included in the S&P 500 average with a market capitalization of $1 billion, it seemed that Stratech might turn out to be a prime candidate for institutional selling once its shares were distributed to Briggs shareholders. Not only was manufacturing locks for cars and trucks unrelated to Briggs's small engine business, but it appeared that Stratech would have a market value of under $100 million, a size completely inappropriate for most of Briggs & Stratton's institutional shareholders. Although Stratech had the makings of a classic spin-off opportunity, it stayed on the back burner until November 1994, when something called an SEC Form 10 was publicly filed. In general, this is the public filing that contains most of the pertinent information about a new spin-off company. A Form 10 is filed in cases where the new spin-off represents a small piece of the parent company. Smaller transactions do not require a shareholder vote. In cases where the spin-off represents a major portion of a parent company's assets, a proxy document is prepared so that shareholders can vote on the proposed split-up. In those cases, the proxy contains most of the same information found in the Form 10. Don't worry about taking notes now. How to go about obtaining these various filings and proxies will be well covered in Chapter 7. Not until January 1995, however, when an amended Form 10 was filed, filling in some of the details and blanks left in the original filing, was it really time to do some work. According to this document, the spin-off was scheduled to be distributed on February 27th. As my first move with any of these filings is to check out what the insiders, key management and/or controlling shareholders, are up to, it was nice to see part of the answer right on the first page following the introduction. Under the heading, Reasons for the Distribution, the board of directors of Briggs revealed the primary reason for the spinoff. The board's motives were classic: to provide incentive compensation to its key employees that is equity-based and tied to the value of Strattec's business operations and performance as a separately traded public company, not as an indistinguishable unit of Briggs. According to this section of the document, a stock incentive plan granting various stock awards to officers and key employees would reserve over 12% of the new company's shares to provide incentives for employees. While this amount of stock incentive may seem generous to an outside observer, as far as I am concerned, the more generous a board is with its compensation plans, the better, as long as this generosity takes the form of stock option or restricted stock plans. In fact, a theme common to many attractive investment situations is that management and employees have been incentivized to act like owners. Investors might well be better off if the law actually granted top executives and key personnel a minimum ownership stake in their employer, as this sort of government intervention is probably as unlikely as it is unwise. You can accomplish much the same result by sticking to investments in companies like Strattec, where management can prosper only alongside shareholders. In addition to checking up on the insiders, it usually pays to spend some time on the first few pages of any Form 10, proxy, or similar document. These pages usually contain a detailed table of contents, followed by a 5 or 8 page summary of the next 100 or more pages. Here is where you can pinpoint areas of interest and choose where to focus your efforts selectively. Frankly, reruns of Gilligan's Island hold more appeal than a page-by-page read-through of an entire proxy or Form 10. So selectivity is key. Not only do these documents have entire sections disclosing the various economic interests of insiders, but importantly, somewhere amid all the verbiage are the pro forma income statements and balance sheets for the new spin-off. Pro forma statements show what the balance sheet and income statement would have looked like if the new entity had existed as an independent company in prior years. According to the pro forma income statement found in the summary section of the Form 10, earnings for Strattec's fiscal year ending in June 1994 came in at $1.18 per share. Excluding some one-time expenses, earnings for the more recent six-month period, ended December 1994, looked to be up a further 10% from the same period in 1993. Armed with this limited information, I tried to take a stab at what a fair price for Strattec might be when it finally started trading at the end of February 1995. As primarily a manufacturer of locks and keys for new automobiles and trucks, Strattec, according to Logic and the Form 10, fell under the category of original equipment manufacturer, OEM, for the automobile industry. The next logical step was to find out at what price most other companies in the same industry traded relative to their earnings. Very simply, if all the OEM suppliers to the auto industry traded at a price equal to 10 times their annual earnings, i.e. at a price-earnings ratio, or PE, of 10, then a fair price for Strattec might end up being $11.80 per share, $1.18 multiplied by 10. Later in the book, we will cover several reference sources that provide the type of data we will need to do our comparative pricing. In this case, I used ValueLine, as it is generally readily available and easy to use. ValueLine's contents are organized according to industry groups. Under the grouping Auto Parts, Original Equipment, I was able to determine that a range of roughly 9 to 13 times earnings was a reasonable range for PEs within Strattec's industry group. That meant that a reasonable price range for Strattec might be somewhere between $10.62 per share, $1.18 times 9, and approximately $15.34, $1.18 times 13. If I wanted to be more aggressive, since Strattec's earnings had grown approximately 10% in the 6 months since the year ended in June 1994, a range maybe 10% higher might be appropriate. While all of this analysis was fine and dandy, Unless Stratex started trading at $6 or $7 a share due to intense selling pressure, I wasn't going to get rich from anything discussed so far. Further, I didn't know much about Stratex industry, but I did know one thing. Supplying parts to auto manufacturers is generally considered to be a crappy business. Certainly, if I did decide to buy stocks in Stratex, Warren Buffett was not going to be my competition. Actually, as a general rule, Buffett won't even consider individual investments of less than $100 million. Here, the entire company was going to be valued at less than $100 million. The interesting part came when I was reading the few pages listed under the heading of Business of the Company. This was not hard to find. It turned out that Stratec was by far the largest supplier of locks to General Motors, and that this business represented about 50% of Stratec's sales. Stratec also provided almost all of Chrysler's locks, and this business totaled over 16% of Stratec's total revenues. From this, I guessed that Stratec must be pretty good at making car locks. The next piece of information, though, got me very interested. According to its filing, based upon current product commitments, the company, Stratec, believes Ford will become its second-largest customer during fiscal 1996, year ended June 1996, if such commitments are fulfilled as expected. This section didn't feature banner headlines like the Wham! Sacco! And Blammo! From the old Batman TV show, but it had almost the same impact on me, since all of the revenue and earnings numbers discussed so far didn't include any Ford business, a new customer expected to order more locks than needed by the entire Chrysler Corporation, was pretty big news. As Chrysler was currently Stratec's second biggest customer, accounting for over 16% of total sales, it made sense that for Ford to take over second place, its new business had to represent even more than 16%. Since GM was the biggest customer with about 50% of Stratec sales, it also meant that Ford's business had to be less than this amount. In short, here was a very interesting piece of information that should substantially increase the value of Stratec's business. My hope was that this information would not be reflected in Stratec's stock price until I was able to make some bargain purchases. From a qualitative standpoint, there was something else about Stratec's business that seemed attractive. Stratec was by far the biggest factor in the automotive lock market. With a majority of General Motors business and all of Chrysler's, Stratec seemed to have a very strong niche. So too, the addition of Ford's business meant that the quality and price of Stratec's products must be headed in the right direction. I figured most of the other OEM suppliers being used for comparison purposes were unlikely to have a better market position than Stratec. All of this combined meant that a P.E. multiple for Stratec at the higher end of the industry range might be appropriate. Of course, I had no intention of buying my stock at the top end of the industry P.E. range, justified or not. However, if it were possible to buy Stratec at the low end of industry valuations, 9x earnings or so, without taking into account the new Ford business, that might be a very attractive investment. The outcome? For several months after Stratec began trading, the stock traded freely between 10.5 and 12. This was clearly at the low end of the industry range, before taking into account 1. The Ford business, 2. Stratec's far better than average market niche, and 3. The recent 10% profit increase during the most recent 6 months. In short, it was easy to buy shares in Stratec at a very attractive price. This was confirmed as Stratec traded to $18 per share before the end of 1995, a 50% plus gain in less than 8 months. Not too bad, and fortunately, far from an unusual spin-off opportunity. Okay, I know what you're thinking. The money's all fine and good, but auto parts? Sheesh, they're so darn boring. No problem. You can have it all, money and excitement, because our next stop is the wonderful world of home shopping. home shopping bonanza. The Cartwrights were never this rich. I didn't think my trip into the world of home shopping was going to be that exciting. Of course, every third trip flipping through the cable box, like everybody else, I would catch a glimpse of a porcelain dog or some other useless item. As my house is filled with ridiculous gizmos and gadgets, most hidden from view for face-saving reasons, and I wasn't a customer, I really had no idea who was buying this stuff. Because the stock had been a notorious high flyer in the 1980s, and I routinely flipped past its channel, I never considered the home shopping network as a potential investment situation. An article that appeared in the premier issue of Smart Money magazine in April 1992 changed that. In an article entitled, 10 Stocks for the 90s, one of the 10 choices turned out to be the home shopping network. The basic premise of the article was that by studying the attributes of the biggest winners of the 1980s, by examining what they looked like back in 1980, a list of winners for the 90s could be compiled. There were several reasons why one of the choices, the home shopping network, caught my eye. First, most of the selection criteria for making the top 10 list involved Ben Graham's value measures, low price to earnings and or cash flow ratio, low price to book value ratio, etc. It was a surprise that a former high flyer like Home Shopping Network had fallen far enough to be considered a value stock. Second, home shopping stock was priced just over $5 per share. While a single-digit stock price in and of itself should be meaningless, many institutions don't like to buy stocks priced under $10. Since in the United States, most companies like their stocks to trade between $10 per share and $100, a stock that trades below $10 has, in many instances, fallen from grace. Due to a lower market capitalization at these prices, or the fact that stocks that have fallen from a higher price are inherently unpopular, opportunities can often be found in single-digit stocks as they are prone to be underanalyzed, underowned, and consequently mispriced. The final reason Home Shopping Network looked to have potential was that, surprise, surprise, a spinoff was involved. That's why we're here in the first place, remember? According to the article, Home Shopping had plans to spin off its broadcast properties to improve the quality of earnings. What this meant, I would find out later. It certainly looked like both the parent company, Home Shopping Network, and the spinoff, Silver King Communications, were worth some more study. According to the Form 10, filed in August 1992 under the heading Reasons for the Distribution, Home Shopping's management stated, "Management believes that the financial and investment communities do not fully understand how to value HSN, Home Shopping Network, in part because HSN is both a retail-oriented company and a broadcast company. Broadcast companies are typically valued based on cash flow, while retail companies are typically valued on an earnings-per-share basis. The categorization of HSN as either a broadcast concern or a retail-oriented company results in the application of a single valuation methodology, when a combination of the two valuation methods would be more appropriate. For instance, the valuation of HSN's retail business, and likewise, the valuation of HSN as a retail-oriented business, is severely discounted by the impact of the substantial depreciation and amortization costs associated with the broadcast assets of the stations. HSN's board of directors believes that the separation of HSN and the broadcast company would allow potential investors to more clearly understand the business of each company, and may serve to attract increased investor interest in and analyst coverage of each company. It turned out that Home Shopping Network had purchased 12 independent UHF television broadcast stations during the 1980s in an effort to expand the reach of its home shopping program. According to the SEC filing, these stations reached approximately 27.5 million households, representing one of the largest audience reaches of any owned and operated independent television broadcasting group in the United States. The only problem was, HSN had paid a lot of money for these stations. That wasn't so bad, but television stations don't have much in the way of assets. Their value derives from the cash stream received from advertising revenues, in Home Shopping's case, one never-ending commercial, not from the amount of broadcasting equipment used to transmit the program. Unfortunately, paying a large purchase price for something that relies on a relatively small amount of fixed assets and working capital to generate profits usually results in a large amount of goodwill being placed on the balance sheet of the purchaser. Goodwill arises when the purchase price exceeds the value of the acquired company's identifiable assets, i.e., assets that can be identified, like broadcast equipment, receivables, and programming rights. This excess in purchase price over the value of these identifiable assets must be amortized, an expense similar to the depreciation charge for plant and equipment, over a period of years. Like depreciation, amortization of goodwill is a non-cash expense that is deducted from reported earnings. Listen to Chapter 7 for a full explanation of these terms. Since a broadcast property is the classic example of a business whose value is not closely tied to the amount of assets employed, broadcasters are generally valued on their cash flow, which adds back the non-cash charges of depreciation and amortization to earnings, not on their reported earnings. Retailers, on the other hand, are valued based on their earnings. Home Shopping's SEC filing stated that figuring out the proper earnings multiple, PE ratio, for the combined business was very difficult. According to the filing, the retail business should be valued based on a multiple of earnings, the broadcaster on a multiple of cash flow. A quick look at Silver King's income statement highlighted this point very clearly. Silver King's operating earnings were slightly over $4 million for the most recent year. Its cash flow, however, totaled over $26 million. $4 million in operating earnings plus roughly $22 million of depreciation and amortization. Since broadcast equipment doesn't have to be replaced that often, capital spending on new plant and equipment was only about $3 million. This meant that, before accounting for interest and taxes, Silver King was actually earning nearly $23 million in cash from its operations. Operating earnings of $4 million plus depreciation and amortization of $22 million, less $3 million in capital spending. If you're a little lost, feel free to check out the cash flow section of Chapter 7. Of course, you wouldn't know that Home Shopping's broadcast division was such a big cash generator merely from looking at earnings. The broadcast properties contributed only $4 million to operating earnings, but as we've already heard, they added over $26 million to Home Shopping's operating cash flow. Since HSN had over 88 million shares outstanding, $4 million amounted to only about 4.5 cents per share of operating earnings lost from spinning off the entire broadcast division. But wait, that's not the whole story. Home Shopping, according to the SEC filings, was going to shift more than $140 million of debt over to Silver King as part of the spin-off process. At an interest rate of 9%, this meant that HSN was going to be relieved of over $12.6 million in annual interest costs, 0.09 times $140 million. The bottom line was that as far as much of Wall Street was concerned, the Home Shopping Network would earn more without the broadcast properties than with them. Reported earnings before taxes would be approximately $8.6 million higher after the spinoff, $12.6 million less of interest expense, now on Silver King's books, while forgoing only $4 million in operating income by spinning off Silver King. Of course, given the huge cash-generating ability of HSN's TV stations, this wasn't the right way to look at things. But that was Home Shopping's point. They believed that investors were not including the value of the TV stations in HSN's price. In fact, considering the debt load taken on to buy the stations, investors may have been subtracting for them. Since HSN borrowed heavily to buy the stations, investors may have subtracted the high interest costs from the stock's value, while only giving credit for the $4 million of operating income, not for the full cash flow. The whole situation had opportunity written all over it. Clearly, Silver King had the makings of an underfollowed and misunderstood spin-off situation. Silver King was going to have over $140 million of debt on its balance sheet. the value of the spinoff was going to be small relative to the value of each shareholder's stake in Home Shopping, hopefully making it inappropriate or unimportant to the shareholders receiving it. The terms of the spinoff called for a 1-for-10 distribution, meaning for every 10 shares an investor held in Home Shopping Network, he or she would receive a distribution of only one share of Silver King Communications. Moreover, Silver King was in a different business, broadcasting, than the retail business originally favored by the parent company's shareholders. And perhaps most important, Silver King was earning a ton of cash that most of Home Shopping shareholders, the ones receiving Silver King's shares, were unlikely to know about. The investment opportunities didn't end there. The parent company, Home Shopping Network, was also worth a look. Since an investor who purchased HSN stock based on reported earnings was probably not placing much value on the broadcast properties, maybe HSN stock wouldn't go down much after the spinoff. If that happened, the combined value of HSN and the spinoff could be more than the pre-spinoff price of HSN. It was even possible that, since Home Shopping's reported earnings would actually go up as a result of the spinoff, HSN stock could trade higher without the broadcast properties than with them. Before we get to the outcome, one more quick point. Whenever a parent company announces the spinoff of a division engaged in a highly regulated industry, like broadcasting, insurance, or banking, it pays to take a close look at the parent. The spinoff may be a prelude to a takeover of the parent company. Of course, the spinoff may merely be an attempt to free the parent from the constraints that go along with owning an entity in a regulated industry. However, takeovers of companies that own regulated subsidiaries are very involved and time-consuming. One unspoken reason for spinning off a regulated subsidiary may be to make the parent company more easily saleable. In other instances, the creation of a more attractive takeover target may just be the unintended consequence of such a spinoff. In Home Shopping's case, there may have been some connection between the decision to pursue the spinoff route and merger discussions. In March 1992, just days after merger talks broke off with its rival in the home shopping business, QVC Network, Home Shopping announced the spinoff of another division, a money-losing maker of call processing systems, Precision Systems. The Silver King spinoff announcement followed several weeks later. At the time, merger talks were called off. Some analysts speculated in the Wall Street Journal that QVC did not want to buy these extraneous operations. While there were good business reasons for both spinoffs outside of making HSN a more attractive takeover target, the spinoffs certainly had the effect of making HSN a simpler and more appealing acquisition candidate. Okay, the outcome. In December 1992, even before the spinoff transaction was consummated, Liberty Media, itself a spinoff from Telecommunications, the country's largest cable provider, signed an agreement to purchase voting control of Home Shopping Network from its founder and largest shareholder, Roy Speer. Days earlier, Liberty had also acted to take control of QVC. The Silver King spinoff was scheduled to proceed as originally planned, though Liberty had now reached agreement to purchase Speer's shares of Silver King, subject to Federal Communications Commission, FCC, approval, due to regulations restricting ownership by cable operators of broadcast stations. The ultimate control of Silver King was left uncertain. In fact, on the eve of the spinoff, Silver King announced it was unlikely that Liberty Media would ultimately be allowed to purchase the Silver King stake. It was in this fast-changing and confused environment that the Silver King spinoff took place in January 1993. The stock traded at approximately $5 per share in the first 4 months after spinoff. This appeared to be an enticing bargain. Although highly leveraged, sometimes an advantage for us, a price of $5 per share meant that Silver King was still trading at less than 5x cash flow after interest and taxes. It was unclear, however, what the future of Silver King would look like. In the past, Silver King's television stations had received a percentage of sales from Home Shopping Network in exchange for airing its shows. What would happen if the Home Shopping Network no longer required Silver King's stations to air its shows? Liberty Media